Are we live?
Hold on. Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. This is night 11 and this is the first stream and it's with Nick Gilvey. Now I should say that I am wearing a sort of fluffy furry shawl thing. It's because it's suddenly a lot colder than it was yesterday. So I might not wear it all night throughout the whole evening, but I thought it was permissible, excusable to wear it at least for this first stream because I'm waiting to warm up. I'll say what's happening tonight. We've got Apostolic Majesty in 2 hours from now, The Franklin in 4 hours from now, and Gregory Hood in 6 hours from now. But first, it's Nick Gilvey. Nick, would you like to introduce yourself? And welcome to Millennial.
Thank you, Woz. And what I got to say, what a magnificent rug you have. It's amazing. I would have gotten my own, but I'm quite comfortable as I am, you know, having functional central heating and all that. My name is Nick Gilvey. Nicholas R. Gilvey is the full pretentious name. I'm a writer for countercurrents.com. You can find my archive of writings there at counter-currents.com/author/NRGilvey. And I also host the Writer's Block, which is kind of like the undercard Countercurrents radio podcast. You can catch us live on the Countercurrents, DLive, and Odyssey channels every Sunday at 10 p.m. Central European time. That's 9 p.m. in the United Kingdom, 4 p.m. on the American East Coast, 1 p.m. on the West Coast. And, you know, it's worldwide. It's one of those shows. I showcase some of the writers on Countercurrents, those who are, in addition to being writers, talkers. And, of course, people from the broader distant right. It's sort of like a graduate school for the distant right. You know how Jonathan Bowden used to say, Countercurrents is the university of the distant right. Well, yeah, the Writer's Block is part graduate school, part rowdy scholar saloon. Now, I used to co-host it with my good friend Full Moon Ancestry, but he has since disappeared into the rural wilderness, into the still as of yet unexplored wilderness of the North American continent, and he's now doing something else. As you may remember, last year I appeared on Millennial with my good friend and former co-host of the Writer's Block, Full Moon Ancestry, but he is now focusing on his fiction. He's now focusing on being a hermit, from what I understand, in the great frozen North American wilderness. But he also runs a show. It's called It's 5 o'clock somewhere. Now, So that's me. That's my story. I've been around for 3 years as a content creator, four more as a content consumer. And that's about it.
All right. And people can find you on Telegram at Nick Gilvey and the Countercurrents one as well. But that should be linked below, I believe. It's easy enough for people to find you. So can you tell people about your perspective, just quickly, so that people understand where you're from and what concerns you have and what interests you have? Because I know that, you know, I read your stuff on Countercurrents, and it's quite varied. In the same way that, like, Mark Gullick's articles are quite varied. They're not. It's not like you just talk about, race or something like that endlessly. For example, the last one I read by you was about time and our perception of time, which is quite interesting. So, would you like to talk about that briefly? Your sort of interests.
Before we do that, I will. Can I do something? I would like to ask you and everyone watching this to pray to your respective gods for the good health of Godfrey Bloom. As people may know, this was his slot, and I got it because I lost my slot due to technical difficulties, and Godfrey rescheduled due to his ill health. And I want to say Godfrey Bloom was one of my bridges from normiedom into the dissident right, and for that I want to thank him. And I will I I will pray for his good health, and so should you, and so should everyone watching this channel, if you would allow me that, Woz.
Yes.
So that's what I have to say first and foremost. And well, as for my perspective, I speak the language, of course, and I understand more or less the culture of the United Kingdom and of America, of the United States, but I'm not American. I'm Macedonian. In fact, I have never been to an Anglophone country. I've never ventured further west than Spain. I've never ventured further north than, well, I actually ventured further north than England, but never been to England, never been to America, never even been to Australia, and I don't understand their culture. I don't pretend to. And I guess this gives me a unique insight into, I get an outsider's view, but it's a nuanced and detailed outsider's view, things that other outsiders may not understand due to the linguistic and cultural barriers I notice, but things that insiders don't understand because they're, you know, swimming around. I speak the language of fish, but I can also see the water. Water is the thing. The metaphor I would use. And with regard to race, I mean, it's a unique thing when you live in a country where basically everyone is white. You don't really feel white. It's again the thing with the fishes and the water. The first time I felt white was when I went to Egypt, and I felt conspicuously white because I'm pale by Macedonian standards, very, very blonde by Macedonian standards, and so is my family, the women folk therein. And Egyptians, they do not hide their perception of you as other, or they don't hide it well. So it really made me feel different. You know, it was a strange thing being seen as a racial outsider by the locals there.
Yeah, I think that's probably the experience similar to the experience I had when I moved to London at the age of 19 and was in a multicultural sort of area for the first time ever in my life. Yeah. You know, that was it does change you, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean,
go on. You feel strange because it's the first time. It's not like I hadn't seen non-whites before, but I on television and in person. I mean, obviously, we are living. I grew up in the 90s and 2000s. We were already a globalized society then. I had already seen a black person in the flesh, a Asian person in the flesh, Arabs. I've even seen a Native American, even though I'm not that well traveled. But it was being seen as the other, as being the racial other for the first time. Because when a black person comes to a white environment, he is the racial other being analyzed, being regarded, being seen by the white perceptor class, the domestic whites, whereas when you as a white person go to a majority non-white country, you know, it's really, really makes you feel your skin and your hair color. They are fascinated by, you know, blonde hair color, and I'm not that particularly blonde. I'm like a dirty blonde with red beard and everything. But they are fascinated by the phenomenon. It's an amazing thing to me.
All right. I mean,
with regard to race. The other part is, you said I'm varied. That's the charitable way of putting it. The uncharitable way of putting it would be that I'm scattered. That I'm still a young man. Well, I'm no longer a young man. I turned 30 in November, so now I've joined the ranks of the decrepit and senile.
You're still young to me.
Right. I'm a millennial, right?
I'm becoming an old goat at this point.
Right. And well, you do have the requisite fuzz draped over your shoulders. I know that with advanced age, cold has a stronger sting than for us young bloods. You know, my blood is still boiling. I still got some boil in this. In these pipes, but anyways, being uncharitable, you would say I'm a master of none pretending to be a generalist, And this is very typical of young men. They're unsure in their footing. They're unsure of what they are, what they ought to be. And this is something I've actually reflected upon. It's like, it didn't have to be like this. I was thinking a lot about it in this last year. You know, last year, this time last year, I was 29. And I know it's a joke, but it's kind of the last year when you're young. The last year when you're a young man. Now I'm just a man. I'm not an old man, but, you know, I'm not a young man anymore. And I was reflecting, okay, what were you doing for the past 30 years? Okay, the first 6, 7, you really have no control over. What were you doing for the next 7? What were you doing for the next 7 after that? And, you know, the 9-year stretch between 21 to 30, when you actually get a little control over your life. And I'm thinking, well, sure, I did some stupid things. I did some smart things, but I also did some stupid things. But that's normal, I guess. And I realized that, well, I'm miseducated, because we are not born as human beings, as complete beings. And this is especially true of men. Women, they're basically, you know, it's easy for them. They lie on their backs, and all right, their purpose in life is fulfilled, right? But what am I supposed to do as a man? Well, I don't know. Somebody's got to tell me. That's the thing. They say you need. It's like that old rap song. They say I got to learn, but nobody's there to teach me. It's "Gangsta's Paradise" by Coolio, I think.
I wrote a Telegram post, but it ended up being far too long, and it was about this topic. That for women, you know, a girl becomes a woman far more easily than a boy becomes a man. To create a man is a process that has to be difficult. There's no easy way to do it. It has to involve sacrifice and struggle and confusion and some failure, at least some failure, because otherwise he won't really learn much, and he won't really become a man. It seems to be becoming aware of your limitations, I think, is a huge part of becoming a man, because as a boy, you just think you're invincible and, you know, and brilliant, or at least I did. and you have to learn, no, you actually are a bit of an idiot. And you have all these, this whole range of failings and flaws. And no, you can't just rationalize them away as unimportant. They clearly are important, because they caused you to fuck up and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So I think the ego, the youthful ego, is something else in a man and a boy. And part of becoming a man is getting that under control and getting other, you know, just other things under control.
Another thing, another way to look at it is that, and I've been thinking about this really, among mammals, we are the most neotenous species of animal on the planet, right? We are the ones who most look like are young, and our maturation period is the longest, right? How long before a man is even sexually fertile? How long before our gametes are complete and you know, our sexual organs and cells are complete? But if you look at it, development of the male brain does not end until age 30. Some studies would say even 33. So and so much of what our development is, our transformation into our final form as full, well-rounded adult, is not even biological. It's social, right? You do not have this in your gene. There are no genes for being a programmer. There are no genes for being a lawyer. Like, I went to law school. I have a law degree. This is not genetic, even though, you know, my parents were both. I may have the predilection, therefore, but it's something I was taught. It's something that was nourished in me. And it's no less part of me than my arm or leg. That's the thing. So our societies are what implant and imprint these, let's call them pseudo-organs upon us. And we live in a sick society, and we know it's profoundly sick because it miseducates the youth. Now, I'm a millennial. I'm of the youngest millennials, right? I think millennial ends with 96. I think.
Yeah, that rings a bell. Yeah, I think that's true.
Maybe 94. I don't know. But I was born in 1991, and
the year of MC Hammer, and
right.
Black and white. Yeah.
I think Top of the Pops on the day of my birth was something Naff by Michael Bolton, which always makes me depressed whenever I think back to that fact. But
is there anything else by Michael Bolton? Is there anything non-Naff by him? But yeah, there was actually a lot of good music in 91. Yeah, that's but anyway, go on.
Right. And anyways, I was watching the Ryan Turnipseed Millennial, and I'm thinking, what the fuck, man? It's like these kids that are coming up after us. I'm damaged. You're damaged. They are crippled. I have recently taken to mentoring a group of Zoomers, you know, in my local neighborhood, really. It's, you know, it's partially political, but it's partially also because I got nothing better to do. And I'm thinking, hey, let's do something positive in the world. And just the degree to which they lack these basic, I don't know, these things I take for granted with regard to being a man. Like, for example, I learned that none of them knows how to throw a punch properly. I say to him, you know, come on, go ahead, punch me in the stomach. I'll clench it. You won't hurt me. They try and just slap punch me like that. Like, they're not putting the weight of their bodies into it. They don't twist their hips. They don't even try. They think it's like a video game where you push a button, and it's like, and it's, this is basic stuff. Okay, I'm not a big fan of criminality, but a man should know how to throw a punch, and a man should know these, you know, minimum. It's like purely for the purposes of sparring, obviously, because
self-defense and protecting the innocent, right. And you know.
And I mean, this is why I encourage everyone to take up martial arts. I don't think you're really a man until you've punched a man in the face, been punched in the face. It builds character, or so I've been told, you know. And it's these things. They don't know how to dress. They complain to me, you know, we got problems with women. I say to them, okay, there's this woman. She's jogging. She's got no bra on, so you know she's up for it. Even if she says no, you know. And they try to, can't even look her in the eye. You know, like, it's just a woman, brah. It's just a woman. But you got to be taught these things. Like, we expect young men to pop out of the womb and be Casanova, but we have to be taught these things. And, you know, my father, he did many things wrong, but at least he taught me how to throw a punch, and he taught me to look a woman in the eye, and he taught me to look men in the eye as well. This is also important.
Yeah. I mean, you'd think it would be obvious that you do need to look her in the eye, because otherwise you're showing how nervous you are. You're showing how scared you are. But I guess this, you know, I'd be interested in hearing your sort of itemized list of the things that they don't have. Again, it's not to have a go at Zoomers. I mean, God knows the millennials are awful as well. But I don't want to be negative. I'm just interested in what you've observed in them.
I wouldn't go for it, because that's the thing. Like I was saying, I keep coming back to this notion of the water to the fishes, right? The things I take for granted, I think are natural in me, or I never don't even remember learning them. You have to be taught. Like, I'm super ultra privileged. My father, again, he did many things wrong, but he did several things right. One of them was he taught me how to swim when I was 3 years old, and he did it by throwing me into the sea. It sounds crazy, but it works. It was really sink or swim, and he would have obviously jumped into the water if I had sunk, but I did not sink. And I noticed this when I was on vacation with a friend a couple of years ago. Actually, it was last year. And we were swimming in a lake, and it was a very cold lake. And I noticed that he was struggling, right? He was struggling to swim, whereas I was like a fish in the water, because I had been swimming since I was 3 years old. I had also played water polo for 7 years, you know, professionally swimming. And to me, swimming is basically, I feel better in water than on land, if I'm completely honest, no, regardless of temperature.
It'd be funny if the camera panned down and you're like, the lower half of you is a mermaid.
Right. No, the pay no attention to the flopping tail behind the curtain. Let me just find. I have an appropriate hat for the occasion. And anyways, my friend, he's very strong. He's 6'3", 240 pounds. Really big guy. He can snap me in half if he so wishes. And I realize that if he has a cramp, and there's a serious possibility that he will in this cold water, and I try to rescue him, he could very easily drown me, right? And, you know, I would approach him from the with the legs out. But that's the first thing. The second thing is he would not know what to do in water, whereas I, having played water polo, having been in the water for almost as long as I have lived, for, you know, 27 out of my 30 years, I've had cramps in the water. They're not pleasant, but you just swim for shore using your other limbs. The key thing is not to panic. But I was taught that by my father, by my water polo coaches, and I was taught to swim. I was taught to rest my muscles, to rest my, you know, cardiac endurance. If I started feeling tired, I was taught to control myself, you know, in water, so I wouldn't, because that's the thing. When human beings are in water, we are land animals. Yeah. We start panicking if it gets in our noses, in our mouths, in our eyes, in our ears. Personally, I mean, I can see underwater about as good as I can see you right now. It's even, you know, it's like looking at a poorly lit room for me, because my eyes are just that accustomed to water, even salt water.
How did we get onto this? Hmm? How did we get onto this?
My point is, all of these things I take for granted, and I'm swimming with my friend in this cold lake, and I did not take into account that basically he has not been taught these things I do, and I'm looking at him, and he looks to me like he's about to have a cramp, and I realize he may be too strong for me to save in that kind of situation. He's a very strong guy, and, you know, add panic to that. And so we turned back. But my point was, all of these things I take for granted about myself, and all of these things you and I take granted as millennials, Zoomers do not have, and we do not know which things. You asked me for an itemized list of things. I cannot give you that, because I do not know which behaviors are genetic and which behaviors are taught.
Right, okay. I think that one thing, and to some extent, generations have said this about the next generation, you know, for a long time. But I think that one thing about them is they don't seem to know how to get along without accidentally insulting someone, or even deliberately insulting someone. And they also don't seem to realize the importance of that. And again, that this would seem, you know, if you psychobabble explanation would be that they're accustomed to just being able to push a button and getting the result they want. They don't understand that once you've insulted someone, that person's then going to think that you're a dick and that they've kind of got it in for you. You can't just treat people like that. You have to be aware of how your words and your wording will impact other people. Now, you know, young people are obviously going to be out of practice in that, of course, but that's why they're taught to be polite. That's why one of the main things is to teach children to be polite. That doesn't seem to have happened with the Zoomers. Maybe it was the same with the Millennials. Maybe it was the same with Gen X. I don't think so. I think there's a sort of and I don't think they mean, at least, to be rude. I think it just sort of happens, and then they're sort of surprised when people react badly to them. It's something I've seen a few times.
I don't know how much leeway we're going to have when I'm going to say this, but fact of the matter is, it's not fed posting. When I was growing up, being rude had a chance of resulting with you getting punched in the face. And I'm talking about schoolyard fights, but also if you insulted an elder, you could get slapped. You know, I don't know if it's a cultural thing, because again, it's Eastern Europe, it's the Balkans. People are more liberal with the corporal punishment around here. But if you were rude to an elder, you could get slapped, or worse, the elder could then report to your parents, who would then kick the shit out of you. And I do mean kick. I mean, they would use their feet, heavy objects, to punish you in later on. So, and we do not use corporal punishment against children anymore. We even think twice before speaking harshly to them. All right. And again, these things have to be taught, right? Politeness is, I think a potential for politeness could be genetic.
Yeah.
But the thing in itself is probably not genetic.
No, I agree. I don't think it is. I mean, you only have to look at a small child and how completely selfish they are, how they have no idea about how their behavior affects other people. So that would seem to be the default. It's almost sociopathic selfishness seems to be the default behavior.
Well, if you let the ID run rampant, it's maybe functionally independent from sociopathy. I mean, for the outside observer, yes, the inner life of the child is not the same as the inner life of the sociopath, but functionally, yeah. And this could be a factor. It's I've noticed too that Generation Z is ruder than we were, and we are ruder than Gen X, and Gen X is ruder than you could say the Boomers, and all the way back to when we had a civilization, you could say.
That's one aspect. I suppose you don't want to go into the other things that you think the Zoomers are lacking in. I mean, as I said, I don't have much experience with them, so
I don't want to sound like I'm putting upon the Zoomers here, but I'm just observing this, and I'm trying to better myself as well, because I realize I'm deficient in many ways. It's embarrassing, because there was, I don't know if you caught the Countercurrents podcast, they had this show with four authors and Greg Johnson, and each recommended five books which are absolutely essential to the development of an intellectual. And I was embarrassed. They came up with 26 books, because 5 times 5 is 26 in writer land. And they came up with 26 books, of which I had read only two. It was embarrassing. And I consider myself well-read, and that's the thing. Other people consider me well-read, but I'm not. I'm not well-read. I'm compared to these people who are, what, maybe 20 years older than I am, compared to people who are maybe, 20, 30 years older than they are, generation before them, we have nothing to be particularly proud of as millennials. I mean,
oh God, no. Yeah, just in case any Zoomers are watching, I'm curious about these things. It's not that I want to, have it in for you or something. It's just an intellectual curiosity. The millennials are, yeah.
We'll get better, It gets better with time. Maybe it's our millennial hubris to expect that we will pop into this world fully formed and then act all surprised, surprised Pikachu, the JPG, that, wait, you actually got to learn, and man learns while he lives, So that's one of those things, I guess.
That's true. And also, as the, the boomers die off, or at least leave, the workplace, Gen X and millennials are going to have to take charge. And
I'm actually dreading that, to be honest.
Yeah,
say what you will about the tenets of national boomerism, at least it's an ethos. Generation X.
I always remember that there was a commenter on YouTube. He used to always appear on JF Garipi's streams, and his username was Tactical Boomerism, and I think that's probably the funniest username I've ever seen. The first time I saw it, I burst out laughing.
I don't know what tactical boomerism is, but it is now my ideology.
I think it means being like boomerish, but when it's tactically useful to be, it's ridiculous.
I think it's a riff on the tactical ANCAPism concept. You know, like leftists, when you complain about censorship, they become ANCAPs temporarily to excuse corporate tyranny.
Exactly. When it's expedient to have that belief, you'll have that belief. It's very funny. But yeah, I mean, the boomers, you know, we've talked a lot about that throughout millennial, probably not just this year. But, you know, it's inevitable. It's not that I want to have it in for them. It's not that I think they're dreadful, that they're wholly a terrible generation. I don't. But they are the ones who are now in the commanding positions of society. So inevitably, they're going to come into for some scrutiny. And their lives, the last 50 years, the culture that they've consumed and celebrated, that is going to be important to what they're doing now. So, of course, there's going to be some criticism of that.
Yeah. I had a run-in with someone who really desperately wanted to be a public person for the past 15 years here in Macedonia. You don't know him. And he was offended that people are now making fun of him, you know, as a public person. Now that he's a public person, people are making fun of him, and he was offended at the very notion. And I said to him, what did you expect? You know, you put your face out there, you put your name, your face out there, people are going to make fun of you. People make fun of me. There are some very hurtful caricatures of me out there on the internet, and I will remember them when I hold the keys to the kingdom. But it's part and parcel of being a public person, of being in the limelight. It's a trade-off, you know. You put your face out there, someone's going to draw you as, you know, he's going to draw himself as a cool and confident Chad and yourself as the soy-drinking soy-jack pointing and soying out at a thing. Oh, yeah, it's one of those things. It's inevitable.
Yeah, you know, that soy-jack thing is so disgusting. There's something awful, and this actually kind of links with what we've been saying, that there's something hideous about grown men, especially after a certain age, like after the age of, like, 25 or 30, where you start to put on a bit more weight. It's disgusting to see a man of that age behaving like a boy. We expect a boy to be frightened, scared, fragile, insecure, whatever. But a grown man, and we also expect a boy to be amazed by things, overwhelmed by things, joyous about things in a certain way. But a man, we don't expect to be like that. So when you see them, like with the consumer product, and they're like that, or when they're shocked by something, and it's like that, and the mouth always sort of in a weird shape, indicating amazement or shock. It's just fucking disgusting.
It's also because they're amazed or shocked by trivialities.
That as well. There's this inability to just deal with life.
Hey, it's like, okay, a man should be frightened of, I don't know, a charging horseman. A man should be in awe of God, a magnificent cathedral, or a man should be fragile with his children, right? Or he should be firm with his children, but he also should show a little love for them every once in a while, I guess. You don't soy out, right? You don't show excitement about a video game product. Play the game. I play video games too, but just this is the most important event of your life. You're going to have this effluvium of emotions over a game, over a toy, over, I don't know, Hillary Clinton getting the Democratic nomination.
I think, and the thing is, I don't want to be an old fart here and joyless. You know, it's fine to be happy about something. It's fine to, it would be a fairly ridiculous life if you didn't have emotional reactions to things. It's the way you, the thing about the soy guy, and it is a real thing in society.
It's definitely real. You can tell them because they're driving around alone and they wear masks.
Yeah. Now, hold on a minute. The thing about them is that they express their emotions in the way that a small boy does. And I think that is what is so gross about them. And that one that's going around now of the two soy guys, and they're pointing at something, and they're both shocked. They're waiting for authority to sort out this problem that's frightening them. It's gross.
It is what it is. I mean, I don't know. You get the theory that it's the spiteful mutants, and I get it. I'm a believer in spiteful mutants, because the other reason why it's so grotesque is because you notice these people, their mouths are crooked, their eyes are uneven in height, their noses are crooked, or, you know, comically large, but that's another thing altogether.
I've got to say, it's like somebody in real time has screenshotted me doing that face.
what a try for a co-op.
In hell. I guess I should be careful what I say, but that was obviously a that is obviously a split second thing, right? I don't go around looking like that all day long.
Put it away. I can't stop laughing.
Awful, awful.
Right. Sorry. Soy out in co-op woes.
All right. Resume where you were. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to show
everyone that. What was I saying? Sorry, I forgot.
That was awful.
Whoever did that, you should be thoroughly ashamed of yourself. Naughty, naughty.
Okay, there was someone called Bruno in MW Public. Thank you, Bruno. Yes. Very, always very amusing.
Anyway, I think I was talking about spiteful mutants, right? And they have crooked faces, crooked mouths. I was looking at a picture of Pretty Patel. You know, who in their right mind would name that thing Pretty? She's not pretty, right? Her mouth is crooked, her eyes are uneven, and let's not even get into the racial handicap. It's just, these people are ugly. And so I'm a believer in the spiteful mutant theory, but also, I think that even people who are not mutants have this behavior because they've not been taught to be men. So they default to boy. It's, you do a lot of thinking, you do a lot of philosophizing, genetics and behavioral and developmental this and psychology that. And in the end, Jesse Lee Peterson was right. I know you're a male, but are you a man? These two are very different things. And if you haven't been taught to be a man, you will not become a man. You have to become a man. Simone de Beauvoir, she said, you know, you are not born, but rather become a woman. And she's right, actually. You have to construct. The left is right when they say gender roles are a social construct. That is true. And they are good. We construct them for the good of ourselves, our society, to secure the existence of our people and the future of our children. This is why we do it, not because we want to oppress women. I mean, the oppressing women thing is just a bonus.
Yeah, and, but the fact that they're a social construct is true, but they're also a social construct that matches with the biological reality. The social construct, the performative gender role, obviously accommodates certain tendencies that are innate in women. And likewise with men, so it's a social construct, but it's not an arbitrary. Like, you would not have, you know, if you just let them do what they like, you would not have women behaving like with male characteristics. It just would not happen. That they're, you know, they're drinking heavily in the pub,
and
they
would not be eusocial characteristic. They would still be female behaviors if you just let women run rampant. They would just not be eusocial. I mean, you had Roger Devlin on.
They'd be like little girls. They'd be princesses. They would grow up to be whores. That's what I mean. It would be an untutored, undirected, insane femininity. Just as with men, if you didn't transform boys into men in a controlled manner, then they would be, mad. It would be violence all the time.
Yes, bring up that still of yourself doing the soy face again. We're getting too serious. I think, it goes back to what I was saying initially, that neither men nor women, but men more than women, We are not complete when we pop out of the womb, and we are not complete when we mature physically. We have to be completed by social, by society, by education, by mentorship, by all of these things.
Acculturation.
Essentially living in a society. We're living in a society. We should be, this should be done. And this goes along with our biological proclivities. I mean, this whole thing, oh, because it's a social construct, is not it's not real. It's a Western perversion, because it's the, I mean, I don't say this, I mean, I'm saying this as an outsider, as someone who belongs to the more or less Byzantine East. You do not see this in Eastern thought, here understood as Byzantine Eastern thought. The Orthodox Church, for example, has no problem reconciling mind-body. The mind-body problem is a feature of Western civilization. I mean, I called it a perversion. It was wrong of me to call it a perversion. It's just, and to me, I think that the bulk of the damage comes from this misconception that the mind and the body are separate or opposed to each other. No, the mind springs forth from the body, and the soul informs both, because it comes from, I mean, in the Christian conception, God. And I think it's, we have enough evidence for that in the material sense as well, to just, it's one of those things, I guess. You see something which was maybe innocuous or maybe even beneficial in the beginning of a civilization, so in its end stages, it's poison which eats out, eats away at it. Oh, it's a category of the mind, therefore it's not real. Well, what makes you think that categories of the mind are not real? I mean, I was, the Jordan Peterson thing, right? Is it Darwinistically true? What does that mean? Does it have ramifications for your survival chances, right? For your ability to pass on your genes, right? Well, in that case, most delusions are more true than most material facts. A rock in Zanzibar is a material fact, but the some superstition which decreases my, like the mask thing, right? There's no doubt that as, you know, Kuf skeptics, our ability to reproduce has been hampered due to our hampered ability to gather resources, put into families, yada, yada, yada. If you refuse to vax your children, they won't let them go to school. So that might actually improve your chances of having grandchildren, but, you know what I mean.
And there are, unless, I think the point is that there are delusions that are useful.
Yeah, and delusions which are far more, that they could be false, but they're very real in the Darwinistic sense. Right? Because what the king believes, it might as well be false, but it's very important for you. You know, if the king believes that men with red beards should be executed, it does not matter that men with red beards are eusocial or not excessively antisocial, because in my experience, us red beards, we are, well, we're asking for it. Let's not kid ourselves here. But it's if it's what the king believes, it's far more real than some rock in Zanzibar or even the facts and logic of our own existence.
And again, this, you know, as you just said, that this is relevant to the current age. And again, something that has amazed me about COVID is it's so obvious that this disease is not very serious. And it's so obvious that the masks probably don't do much, and it's so obvious that the vaccine doesn't seem to work as advertised, and yet people believe whatever authority tells them. So, you know, we used to think that we lived in a rationalistic age in which arbitrary power, man-made power, couldn't make arbitrary declarations, and people wouldn't just accept it, but they do. It's been a real eye-opener.
It's power is a fact, and power is a social construct, but it is the most preponderant fact, you know, most powerful fact out there. This social construct, because what is power? You know, yeah, you think, okay, let's take the classical example. Why does the king from ages 9 to 99 have power? Because men obey him. Why do men obey him? Because they believe in his authority. What's his authority? It's a social construct. Why does the king have authority? Why does the priest have authority? Why does Boris Johnson have authority? Why does Klaus Schwab have authority?
Yeah.
Why? These are all social constructs.
It's because everyone agrees that they are. It's the same, like, why does Bitcoin have value? Because everyone agrees that it has value. Yeah.
Right. Social consensus, which is a social construct, right? It's the same thing. It's probably the most powerful and most real thing on this planet. Far more real than some facts and logic. It's like that thing, feelings don't care about your facts, right? Wait, yeah. Facts can be changed. Maybe this is the lawyer in me saying, but facts can be very easily changed. Or they can just not be admitted into evidence, right? That's a thing. Yeah, it's real, but the court will not recognize it as evidence because of some reason or other. Most of the reasons are good. That's the other thing. I'm sorry, we are a bit scattered.
Yes. Well, I was just sort of letting the conversation go as it went. I think if you want to, I mean, yeah, it's difficult to know how to wrap this up. You were talking about arbitrariness and things. Yeah. So I don't know how we got onto that. We were talking about the generations.
Yeah. I'm having a great time.
Yeah. It probably doesn't really matter how we got onto it. So you wanted to talk about how we can win. So I guess if you want to get onto that.
Right. So a little bit of background before. So I'm a writer for Countercurrents, right? So I write this article, which is called Loser Nationalism. And I'm leaning into a stereotype here that, you know, nationalists are losers. And it's something that was pointed out to me by a conservative that basically all of the, let's say, historical regimes I have a degree of admiration for. You know, let's not bring them up all. I brought up three relatively politically correct: the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Confederate States of America, and the Republic of Rhodesia, right? And some others, but let's not talk about them, right? Or can we? You know, actually,
I don't think we need to. Let's just
mum's
move
the
forward.
Yep. Mum's the word. And this guy said to me, okay, all these people you bring up, even, you know, mi general Augusto Pinochet, all these people, they lost. So what's this fascination with the losers? I'm like, well, I'm not fascinated with them because they lost. You're putting the cart before.
Oh, God. This is such a retarded thing to say. It's like when people say, well, and, you know, you might have legitimate complaints or criticisms to make of the Third Reich and National Socialism. But to say that it's crap because that side lost the war is a fucking retarded thing to say. And you hear people say this, especially centrists, these awful spitfire nationalists, that those kind of morons will say this because it's a gotcha. They think it's a clever way to win the argument. Well, if it was so good for them, how did it make them lose the war? it's like you fucking midwit. I find it disgusting.
Well, see, it's not just midwits, right? Two very, very, or so they claim that they are smart people also believe this. The first, Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, you know, his theory of the historical dialectic is that ideas are carried by men, by nations, and the dialectic goes on not by facts and logic and argumentation using Marcus Queensberry, but by war. And he said that the idea that all men are free and equal won out because Napoleon basically smashed everyone who disbelieved in it to pieces. And all of his enemies, all of Napoleon's enemies, adopted this idea just so they could defeat Napoleon. This was it was considered a necessity at the time, an expediency at the time, with conscription and mobilization of national and industry to produce artillery, yada, yada, yada. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't even matter who won the Napoleonic Wars. This concept of everyone is free and equal, they won. That's the first guy. The second guy is Nick Land, the progenitor of accelerationism. He's like, basically, the gods favor those who win, therefore those who win are favored by the gods, and hence you get the various, and this is actually runs through the entirety of neo-reactionary philosophy. Well, I wouldn't call it philosophy, neo-reactionary thought. Well, I wouldn't call it thought. through the entirety of neo-reactionary grunting, let's call it. It runs through this that, well, basically things that win are good because they serve the they serve Gnon. This is very anti-Christian as well, because we know who's the master of this world, and these people will often pretend to be Christians. And that's another thing. So it's not quite as midwit as it sounds. It's still, you know, a stupid fucking idea, but it can be reached through, let's say, very intellectual nonsense as well.
It can. I mean, look, I understand if you're saying you're going to climb a mountain and you've got this safety equipment and this safety equipment, and you know, one of them, the people who use it frequently die, and the other equipment, it saves lives. Then obviously you're going to conclude that one of them is Darwinistically good and the other is bad. But when it comes to ideology, there are 100 different reasons why a side might lose a war. That it has nothing to do with their ideology. It could be circumstances, the geography, bad luck, military preparedness, or the sheer size of their opposition, the sheer scale of what they're fighting.
Things you have control over, and some of these things ideology is related. Like, for example, Napoleon's ideology, which was French moderate Jacobinism. I'm trying to think in three languages at once. It's it allowed him to conduct levée en masse, which is mass conscription, and this was a factor. And basically all of these things. So it is a factor. I recently finished an article for countercurrents.com, which tries to explain why, as a practical necessity of statehood, Atatürk decoupled Turkish culture, or tried to decouple Turkish culture from Islam. And basically, even though I don't approve of it, because, you know, I don't like faithlessness in society and faithlessness in the state, it had to be done at the time, I guess. And so, you know, this is a consideration to take. But for the most part, yeah, war does the winning in a war does not usually determine that you are A, right, or B, that even you're the better warrior. Because I've been reading Karl von Clausewitz's On War, Vom Kriege, and he's very adamant that, yeah, I'm going to give you all of these tools to wage war properly. But do not discount the possibility that you might lose just through sheer bad luck. War is the human activity which most depends upon luck. That's something that Clausewitz said, and it's something echoed by Caesar in his autobiography, you know, the thing he wrote when he went to Gaul, that basically he is favored by fortune because he is Caesar. And as someone with martial arts experience, I will tell you, luck plays a far bigger role in fighting than you think. It's, skill plays a large role, a huge role. Strength, speed, reaction time, all of these things. I have an edge because I have very high pain tolerance, so I can take a lot of punishment before keeling over. That's my superpower in fighting. But luck plays a big role. And I also have an article on Countercurrents about this, that basically we modern people disregard luck. We do not take it into account, whereas our ancestors lived and died with their luck in their hands. Like, they trusted in luck, they trusted in God, they trusted in fortune, they trusted in their destiny. And most of the time, they lived better lives. And that's another thing. When you let go, when you're not a control freak about your life, when I do my best and God will see us through, right? Or as the Muslims say, inshallah, you know, God will see us through. You're relaxed. I mean, like Mrs. Jilby, I think she's watching. She's very worried about the consequences of the coup, world order, whatever, flu world order. And I say to her, look, we will do our best. We will refuse the demon jab. We will not submit. We are unjabbed, unschwabbed, pure bloods. We're going to have a brood of pure blood children, and God will see us through, right? We will win. Even if you and I personally do not live to see victory, we will win. That is our destiny. And That's an elephant off my back. That's my risk of cardiac arrest decreased.
Yeah. I suppose this desire for control, or the desire to not rely on luck. Yeah, and also it's, I think it's a product of over-civilization, where we expect basically the state or our society to look after us, to eliminate even bad luck from life.
Yeah.
I would surmise. I might be wrong.
There is an element of that. I always recommend people read Anti-Fragile by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Now, he's gone a bit gaga over the flu and IQ before that. But when he wrote Anti-Fragile, he was still sane and very smart, I would add. You read that, you realize that the problem of the world we have today is that the people who rule us, and we as well, are obsessed with its controllability, measurability, and this actually goes back to representability as elucidated by Martin Heidegger, where he says that the problem of Western metaphysics, starting with Plato and Aristotle, is that we want to reduce being to that... what we can carry with us in our minds, what we can represent in our minds. And we are ignoring that bit which is not just invisible to us, but maybe categorically unknowable to us, or the unknown unknowns in Donald Rumsfeld speak. And because Heidegger says, you know, right now I'm looking at you and I'm looking at my laptop, but I cannot see its backside, and I cannot see its backside while I'm seeing its front side, so the thing is representing itself to me, yada, 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 yada. Anyways, thing is, the West is obsessed with this representability, which translates into measurability, which translates into controllability in the field of action. And this is why in the West, in its degenerate form, is so heavily bureaucratized. These people want to control everything through spreadsheets, right? This is the philosophy of governance, of global governance, but also of local governance and of self-governance, also of household governance, right? The helicopter mom, she wants to control every facet of the child's life. She might even take his temperature every day. This was done on a child I know. He is now very mentally unstable. He's 23 now. It's one of those things, I guess.
What temperature is he?
36 degrees Celsius every day of his life, except when he was sick. People's temperatures usually taken. Hold on a second, Woz. Can you talk? I have to take something.
Okay. I should have said at the start of this that Nick was supposed to appear last night, but there was a technical screw up. Something between StreamYard and Odyssey, and people noticed it at the time, and we ended up aborting the stream about less than 10 minutes in, which, you know, thank God it hadn't gone on a huge length of time. And then today, I'm sorry that I didn't mention this myself, Godfrey Bloom was due on now in this slot, but he had to cancel because he's not well just now. So I just transferred Nick's to this slot. I obviously wish Godfrey the full and speedy recovery. He was well loved last year when he appeared, and it was one of those surprise things. I wasn't sure whether he would agree to appear or not, but he did. So it was nice, and we had a great stream. It was a really enjoyable conversation. So I was looking forward to having him on again this year, but maybe something will be arranged in the future. I'm not sure. Yeah, it really depends. But you know, these things happen. And with Millennial, there was another cancellation due to a family emergency, and that was Idealism Identity, which is a philosophy discussion group on, I think, Discord. And they were going to appear. And that one hasn't been rescheduled. But in addition to that, there are, I don't know, I think maybe five or six guests who wanted to appear this year, but I just couldn't accommodate them. There just weren't enough slots. So it is a busy thing. And he's back. Right.
Sorry about that. Mrs. Gilvey needed an emergency shag. we're all down now. Well, how long does it take you?
All right. Well done. Well done.
Just finish your thought, and I'll.
I was finished. That's me.
Oh, okay. And anyways, I'm putting this in the Heideggerian lens because I learned about Heideggerian thought. You know, Martin Heidegger's thing about being. And everything, rescuing being from the clutches of the representational Western metaphysic tradition. But at the time when I read Nassim Taleb's Antifragile, which was 2014, it was the first time I had ever thought like that. That I don't have to measure everything. I don't have to control everything. And people lived for millennia, and they lived happy lives. Not being in control, not knowing everything. Like you said, I'd rather be dumb and anti-fragile than smart and fragile. And he talks about this anti-fragility, this concept of being exposed to uncertainty, accepting uncertainty, and benefiting from it. Do not let uncertainty eat away at you. And this is he gives examples from economics, from the labor market. He gives example, but it's primarily psychological. We have to be at ease with uncertainty. And I tried bringing this up in the various comment sections when I started becoming interested in your reaction. And all of these people, they just could not get it. Like, oh, we're going to solve this problem, which you point out, this uncertainty you speak of. We're going to have better computers. I'm like, don't you people get it? And this is why I'm confident that the Great Reset and the Flu World Order will fail. Their computers cannot account for everything. Hell, we cannot account for everything with our biological supercomputer brains. How are puny computers going to compete? They will not compete and they will not compute. I'm sorry. Tactical Russo boomerism over there.
All right.
That's the thing with, but it was ignored. It was, and I want to thank, you know, as long as we're thanking elders, you know, I want to thank Nassim Taleb. He opened this door for me of thinking that it does not have to be like that. I don't know if he is a Heideggerian thinker. I think he may have just reconstructed bits and pieces of Heideggerian thought just from, you know, existing reading the ancients.
All right. So, do you want to get onto the things that the program for winning that you talked about?
Oh, I started talking about that one, did I?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. Like, I depend on people to remember for me because my brain is like 98% RAM. It's one of those things, I guess. It's a curse. Anyways. I wrote this article called Loser Nationalism, right? Which is about losers. And so, like, why do you support losers? And I said, well, you know, it's one of those things, I guess. I don't support them because they lost, but because I like aspects of those regimes. And there was a response to it. It was like, okay, yeah, we get it. We lose. But another thing, okay, let's be realistic. We have been losing consistently in history. So you got to learn how to own that loserdom, right? You got to learn how to be a loser and keep on going, because I saw there was a lot of priming for this in the run-up to the American presidential election in 2020. People were primed to accept victory as legitimacy for, well, everything, right? And that's the argument that the alt-right put against us and the conservative put against us. Well, we may be spineless, worm crawlers, spineless, slimy entities, but we win, whereas you lose, and we will win, and you will lose, and that legitimates us and doesn't legitimate you. You know, they get all smug, and they get that crooked smile, and you wish punching them in the face was legal. Disavow, disavow, disavow. And then they lost. And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, Trump did not lose the election per se, but they had their teeth kicked in. And I was ready to point and laugh at them, but, you know, just my empathy kicked in and I'm like, okay. So let's think about this. How do we fragilize ourselves to defeat, anti-fragilize ourselves or robustify ourselves to defeat? Because we're going to lose, right? That's the thing you learn when you're a martial artist, and I've been doing martial arts for some time. And the thing you learn doing sports in general, like in water polo, you will lose. It will happen. But, you know, there's no, you must not allow it to devastate you psychologically, because what are you going to do? You're going to die after you lose? You're going to stop playing sports? You're going to never fight again? I don't think so. And anyways, I was thinking, okay, we got to robustify people's psyche. Now, what did I do for myself in sports, in business, in life, in philosophy, in politics? Let's try and think of a program to do it. And I said to people, okay, implement these things which I have developed over the years. Go read Anti-Fragile by Nassim Taleb. Go read Seneca the Younger. Read the Stoics. They're very good at losing with, you know, and not going to pieces. Go read the Buddhists if that's your thing, because that's more or less the same thing. Inure yourself to the ways of the world. Go read my good friend Full Moon Ancestry's essay on the ways of the world and how the Mormon Church taught him, because, you know, he was raised Mormon, to basically steel himself to the ways of the world, as the Mormons call them, which are, you know, the degeneracies, the pressures, the temptations, yada, 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 you know. And someone said to, and I said to them, and let uncertainty work in our stead. So I basically gave them the Nassim Taleb prescription. And someone said to me, well, okay, that's very nice, but what did we do? Well, we hope that our luck changes. Yeah, our luck could change. Stranger things have happened. I mean, and I'm like, okay, this deserves a response. Let's come up with a game plan. We don't have to implement it. Let's think about it. What does the regime need to function? You know, what does any regime, what does any state type entity, or, you know, global state type entity need to function? It needs men. It needs material. It needs money, stuff like this. You know, very basic stuff. How does it secure? Can we hit its money supply? No, it controls the money supply. Can we hit it materially? No, it owns all the resources on the planet, or can buy them from China, right? Assuming China's not part of the global home, which I'm not 100% certain, right? Men, right? Personnel. Ah. Now that's getting interesting, right? They are running out of personnel. That's why everything is shit. They don't have enough white men to keep the institutions running. That's why they had their asses handed to them by a bunch of toothless goat lovers in Afghanistan. And yes, I've heard some theories that, oh, they actually planned it and it's a 4D chess move. Yes, okay, let's go with that. But for the time being, let's say that Afghanistan, the thing that happened in Afghanistan is the same thing that happened in 1999 in Yugoslavia, when NATO bombarded Yugoslavia and they managed to inflict a lot of civilian casualties on, you know, trains and hospitals and stuff like that. But they did not manage to destroy the Yugoslav National Army's equipment. Because they were incompetent. It was a case of gross incompetency. And that's one thing. So let's not see Afghanistan as the way we want to, maybe the American imperialist types would like to see it. Let's see it in the way that it was. It was a big, fat, fucking L for the Globo Homo Empire. Okay, how did that happen? They're running out of white men, especially in the military. They cannot replenish their institutions with diversity.
But they want to, though. They're driven to do that. They don't want to employ white men. That's the trouble. And if they do employ white men, then they want to keep them at a low level.
Right. Well, you know, you can maybe make that swing for a couple of years. Okay. But it's not just the military. What's the big complaint I hear from Americans? Our infrastructure is crumbling. how big of a deal it is to fix a road. You know, so if the infrastructure is crumbling, that tells me that the institutions which are supposed to take care of the infrastructure are crumbling. Institutions crumble because they run out of money, they run out of material, or they run out of men. So they're running out of men because, you know, they got infinite money, infinite material. Okay, moving on. The various companies in the West, what exactly do they do aside from rehash decades-old technology? You know, oh, they got control of supply chains, but they're assing that up too, right? Again, do they have money? They're swimming in it. Do they have material? Infinite material. What are they lacking? Men. They're lacking personnel. They're trying to cover up paper over the losses with, you know, Indians and Chinese and Eastern Europeans. Now, Eastern Europeans, I've been trying to convince them not to do it. But if you let Indians or Chinese into your company, you know, they start eating it up. You know, they're like cancer cells. All you're going to get is more Indians, more Chinese. And the Chinese parts, they're sort of kind of going to function, but not really. And the Indian parts are just going to drain resources.
Yeah, and probably not be able to innovate. I mean, if we're going by stereotypes, the Chinese parts will not be able to adapt.
And because of their narrower IQ distributions, you're not really going to get a lot of bright Chinamen. You know, the average is higher there, but the distribution is narrower. So, you know, guys of our IQ level, they're not very common in China, despite it being a big country. And if you fill it with Indians, it's basically a tumor on the institution. Let's not mince words there. I'm of course talking, of course, in organizational terms, disavow comparison of ethnic groups with diseases. I'm using because it's a corporate thing, right? Corporis comes from
the
body.
Well, you know, this is worth going into actually, because there is a modern phenomenon that seems to be undeniable, where you've got a high IQ Indian getting in charge of, I think, Google and Twitter. definitely Twitter now. And there are others as well. I saw a list, like it was five different big tech corporations that are all headed by, you know, some Brahmin Indian guy. What would you say about that?
Well, it's like academic agent said, you know, small organized minorities. This is a small organized minorities which has been more or less ruling India since the time of Emperor Ashoka. They're the best at it. They're the most nepotistic. These people, I don't think they believe their shit smells, right? Have you ever interacted with a Brahmin? They're the most arrogant people on the planet. And that's saying something coming from a Macedonian.
Well, yeah, I've had some experience with Brahmins, yeah. Yeah.
So you know, all of the things we accuse the Jews of, they're that and worse, and they're better at it than the Jews. That's the thing. And that's why they're pushed. It's like they
Well, some people accuse the Jews of these things. I certainly don't.
They push the Jews out of the Amsterdam jewel market. This is how good these people are at the minority nepotism thing.
Well, do you think they might push them out of big tech? Do you think that's what's happening?
No, I don't. I mean, have the Jews really ever had a toehold on big tech, aside from Zuckerberg? And
well, then I see maybe. Susan Wojcicki at YouTube. But yeah, let's not get into that.
Global Homo, they have a shortage of men. That's what I'm saying. And yeah. They might think they can paper over the lack of white men with strong, independent women of color, or in practice paper over with Brahmins and Han and Jews and whatever, very smart Eastern Europeans who are very greedy. But it's starting to hurt them. And I say, okay, they have given us, they have exposed their wounded flank to us. Like, think of it as a wounded animal. It has exposed its wounded side to us. How about white men just walk away from the system? That's the thing. Just not the whole. I mean, there was this thing, white strike, all white people walk away from the system right now. And something like that is not going to work. But I'm just saying, I'm putting it out there. Put the worm of that into the minds of white guys, and not all white guys, but white guys who can do irreplaceable labor.
I mean, ideally, you would starve the system by, and you can't starve it of money, obviously, but you can starve it of your own skills. And the more precious those skills are, the better. The more of a blow it will be to the system. What I would say is people should join. Hold on a minute. What I would say is that people should join companies, organizations that are of our mind, so as to strengthen those.
Yes, and so my go-to example is the fighter pilot, or even just your regular old airline pilot. Because, I mean, yeah, airlines are in the toilet right now, and air travel might not be as key an industry as it once was, but still, they're going to need fighter pilot, right? They cannot replace fighters with drones. They cannot even replace the regular bombers with drones. The drone technology is just not as advanced. People are saying, oh, drones are the future of warfare. They are very in warfare right now because there are no major wars, right? Afghanistan, what are you fighting against? Taliban with RPGs? Yeah. You can cause them trouble with wars. The Nagorno-Karabakh war in Armenia, yes, these are two low-technology, small nations duking it out. Yes, they have bigger players backing them. But there is no serious air force there. There is no serious Armenian or Azerbaijani air force. Someone was saying that seeing the success of the Azeris, the Ukrainians have purchased a bunch of drones to use against the Russians. And so, like, okay, you people don't understand drone technology, right? The Russian Air Force can wipe these things out like that with fighter jets because they're faster, more maneuverable than drones. They have better armaments because the Russians have fighter jets and, very important, they have fighter jet pilots. They have fighter pilots. And I don't know who pointed out, I think it was Thomas Steuben, who writes for Countercurrents, also semi-regularly appears on the writer's block. He used to be in the Air Force, I think. He says aviation, not just flying the planes, aviation in general, including maintaining, it's a white guy thing, right? It's something white people did and something that, you know, non-whites, they can do. I mean, I've flown an airplane flown by a non-white. Well, actually, he was white, but he was Turkish. Turks are basically white. And it's a white guy thing, you know. Without white guys, they do not have aviation, you know. And my go-to thing is like, okay, you're a fighter pilot. You were born to do that. I'm going to have to ask you to make the ultimate sacrifice. Set fire to your dreams, right? Sacrifice your ultimate potential, right? Because all of us were born with our potential, especially if you're gifted, right? If you're a gifted fighter pilot, you can only reach your potential if you have access to the capital with which you can mix your labor and do great things. And the capital you need to mix your labor with, if you're a fighter pilot, is a fighter jet. You cannot do great things in a crop duster. I mean, you can dust crops, and that's great, but they're not great things like a fighter pilot is, right? I can get a pilot license and fly a crop duster, and I'm pretty clumsy, right? In the air, I mean, in the water, I'm basically a shark. Another thing, like I've been offered multiple times here in Macedonia to be a district attorney, right? B, a judge. C, I don't know how to say this, senior positions in the three largest political parties, right? They want me to manage the local thing or whatever. I said no to all of those things because I want to starve the system of my labor. They need guys like me, right? I mean, I don't want to toot my own horn. People were criticizing Mark Malone about, naming his IQ. I'm not going to do that, but it's high. But it's not just the IQ. It's the attitude. It's the go-getter thing. It's, you know, having taken many punches to the face. I know a thing or two about things. I'm just going to deny all of that to the system, right? And I don't tell people go in the woods and be a hermit. I say, if you have the potential to be a great chemist, open a bakery. Starve the system of your unique labor. And if you know a guy, a white guy, who can provide unique labor to the system, go and talk to him about anti. You just laser focus your evangelism on smart fraction guys. Smart fraction goes 108 and up. I say narrow it down even further. Your the lowest IQ guys you should be talking to with the regard to these things is 120, right? Because that's where irreplaceability becomes a factor.
Yeah, and this is a high effort thing. So you want to concentrate your efforts where they're most going to have the most effect.
Right. That's my road to victory. Now, you don't even have to convince them. Just put that worm of doubt in their heads. Although, thank God, the Great Reset, these things have put the worm of doubt in everyone's head right now. And don't just limit yourself to white people. Like, you know, an ultra talented mestizo, castizo, black guy, Russian, whatever, all of these people, just go talk to them too. Just say, okay, yeah, you're favored right now because you're non-white, you're black, you know, you're like a unicorn, a black pilot. These people are fucking evil. Once they're done with us, they're gonna kill your people too. You know, because I think that's gonna happen, actually. And maybe not kill, but they're definitely gonna grind them up into this faceless mush. The identity of black American, of black Kenyan, it's gonna disappear.
Well, what it's is not, black, you know, really? Etc. That it will just start with them. What they want is for everyone to. I mean, obviously, just now all of these other groups can be used to attack whitey. So their group identities are useful,
but they're what, not. They're not if, being respected.
Hold on a minute. But once whitey is defeated, if that happens, then those group identities are then a hazard. They're a risk, a liability. So they'll be dissolved as well, and they'll be converted into just generic coffee-colored consumers. That's ultimately, I think, what the system wants and needs.
Right. There's an article of Concord's, I forget its titles. Is it okay if I use a racial slur?
In a title?
No, it's not in the title, but the phrase he used is magnificent, but it contains a racial slur beginning with end, ending with.
Oh, fuck's sake. I don't know. It's more a matter of the tone. We know the word, so just say the rest of the title.
It's not the title. I don't remember the title, but he was talking about non-whites he knew in America. Right. One of them was Costa Rican. The other was, I think, Yemeni Arab or maybe regular Arab. And they were fighting, and both of them were listening to rap. Both of them were wearing those, you know, jeans around their knees and everything. And they started fighting for whatever reason. And they said to each other, I'm going to kill you, nigger, and fuck your mother, nigger. Or maybe they said nigga. I don't know. And it's like, okay, thousands of years of history, Costa Rican, Arab, Asian, whatever. They all get squished into this gooey category of nigger, right? It's not even just blacks. It's basically urban American, not white,
yeah.
Or Hispanic whites. They get it's one of these things. They're coming for non-whites as well. They're going to grind them up into the great civilizational death engine as well. Maybe after they're done with us, but it's happening to them concurrently as we speak. There's another great article. Mulatto perm haircut, right? With the thing with the kids have. God, I fucking hate that. In the ethno state, having such a haircut will be punishable with 30 lashes. You know, the when they curl up their hair and shave the sides, the broccoli hair, right?
That
should be punishable with beatings. And it's like it. I think it does something to the shape of the face or the head when you look at the guy and makes him look racially ambiguous for whatever fucking reason. Or maybe it's because we associate curly hair with Jews. I don't know. It's non-white identities are being ground down as well. It's low key, and it doesn't mean it doesn't really concern us, but it is happening. And so, yeah, even if you find the one in a million high IQ, very competent black person or, you know, mestizo, Arab, Asian, who can provide irreplaceable labor to the system, try to dissuade him as well. You just put that worm of doubt in his head. You don't really have to convince him. Just put that worm of doubt in his head, and the system will do the rest. And that's my road to victory. We starve him of essential labor. Now, the other part is we should, in as much as possible, try to attract that essential, irreplaceable labor to our side. Now, our problem is we don't really have the capital to do that. And I'm not just talking about money. Like, how are you going to say, okay, I'm not going to be a fighter pilot for the American Air Force? Okay, where's the dissident Air Force? Well, we don't have one. We're not going to have one. We're not a state. When we are a state, we're going to have one. Now, what is he going to do? He's going to work for the Russians? No, I don't think it's as simple as that.
Yeah, that is a problem. Yeah, it is. I don't have an answer to that. And of course, it also relies on... It suggests that we would have to form an ethnostate in order to inject resources and money into that, which in turn suggests that it would have to be a mixed ethnostate, like mixed white, which I think a lot of people wouldn't like. But the alternative is, well, each of our countries has to form a sort of ethnostate segment. Which I don't know. I mean, this is all LARPing, and
It's not that difficult. I mean, it happened during the Habsburg Empire. Croatia was basically a Croatian ethnostate, but you know, more or less autonomous, but part of the Hungarian Empire, Austro-Hungarian, the Hungarian part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I mean, parts were Austrian. It's not unfeasible, and. I've proposed solutions for, you know, squaring the circle of ethnic nationalism, you know, having this big flag behind me and white nationalism because I have this skin. And by the time I explain to people, to, you know, the non-white hordes, the brave history of the Macedonian people, our heroes, our songs, the courage and hubris of Alexander, they will just throw me into the gulag with the rest of the Mayo monkeys. So that's, you know, something to think about.
All right. Okay. Well, we've been going for an hour and a half, so we'll do the questions now. Let me just entropy up. And okay, Garib just posts a smiley face. Thank you for that.
Garabe.
Okay, and. Mystery commenter said the gap between this is when we're talking about generations. The gap between generations is much larger than anyone realizes. We no longer live in a world of order. What do corporations care about? Gender, race, and feelings. What do we see in government? Whatever government wants. Any young man playing by the rules is losing. Younger men live in utter chaos. There's a lot there. Do you want to comment on that?
I agree with the man. I'm interested in the thing about the generation gap. I think he's right. I don't know. See, that's the thing. Generational culture is a very recent phenomenon.
Yeah.
It's when you have segmented media, right? Historically, yeah. We didn't even have media. In the context of human culture, and your parents' culture was your culture. Whereas growing up, that was very interesting to me. I was observing because I'm one of these very strange autistic children. I'm 5 years old, and I noticed that my parents listened to one type of music and my grandparents listened to another type of music. And further nuance, right? When my mother and father, they're this generation, they listened to this particular specific type of music, and my aunt, who's 9 years younger than my mother, that's a big gap, she listens to a different kind of music, right? My mother, she's into the sort of disco and a little bit of the lighter glam rock of the 80s, whereas my aunt, she's into heavy metal, a little bit of grunge, a little bit of hard rock, you know, one of the these things, I guess. And then you look at us. I mean, you and I, we probably have very different music tastes. You're probably one of those synthesizer people, whereas I'm not one of those synthesizers, although I do appreciate good electronic music as well. But this was simply not the case. Like, what is the age difference between you and me, Wolves? Like 8 years, 9 years?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, you would have probably been the elder guy you looked up to. in the playground, and I would have absorbed culture from you and from my parents and from my grandparents, and we would have liked the same songs. We'd have probably worn the same style with minor differences. So culture evolved from generation to generation, but it was. I'm sorry. The chat. Someone in the chat says Nyx is into elevator music, which is more true than I'm willing to admit, but it is so. It is so.
Well, you can see you find it uplifting.
That's why I love you, Woz. I mean, the
I just came up with that. I just came up with that right now. That's
a five children minimum dad joke. Jesus.
Sorry. Christ. Just pretend that I didn't do that. Keep going. Keep going.
I'm sorry. I got distracted. Whereas future would generations would morph, would blend into one another historically. Now they're a vessel very neatly segmented, right? The boomers are into hippie shit, and the Xers are into the screamo grunge shit, and us millennials were into the gay shit, and the zoomers, they have zero taste in music.
Well, I guess for the millennials, it would be that sort of awful 2000s indie stuff. And then for the zoomers, it's just
It wasn't atrocious. That bad. It got me late.
Hold on a minute. And for the times. For the zoomers, it would be the atrocious like R&B, like this god awful modern black stuff, urban. You know, fuck.
Dreadful. So yeah, that's my response to it. Yeah, you're right. You stated a bunch of true things there in that super chat guy.
Okay. Well said. I don't know what it was that we were referring to. Every great thing that we whites create now in the West feeds the filthy. He's talking about denying them that. Okay, thank you for that, spiteful mutants. And then Luke says, he asks the question, how many punches to the face do you think it would take to make one a super genius?
I've been trying my entire life, and I've successfully decreased my IQ by 10 points. So when I lose another 50, I think I'll be a super genius, or at least I'll consider myself one. That seems to be the case. You know, you got to get that Dunning-Kruger Goldilocks zone where you're just smart enough to think you're a brilliant genius, but not smart enough to realize you're pretty fucking stupid. So
then you become a centrist YouTuber.
But I was pretty good at fighting, so I've not taken too many punches to the face. So you got to move your head. You got to remember to move your head. Put your hands up. Or I'll staple them to your forehead, as my coach used to say.
All right. Gadius Maximus. According to Gallup polling, Macedonia is the country that is least accepting of immigrants. I attribute this directly to Nyx Gilvey. Merry Christmas.
Another thing is, there was another poll. I don't know if it was true, if it's true, because I've learned not to trust polls, but apparently we're the European champions of distrusting people with dark skin. And the runner-ups are Croatians, and I don't know who got third place. It was another country in Eastern Europe. And I think it's, like I said, when I went to Egypt, it was the first time I felt white. But that was not my first encounter with non-whites on a massive scale. No, if you grow up in Eastern Europe, you become aware of the gypsies, right? And they are, woes, you're muted. Anyways, they are...
No, I wasn't coming. I was just saying, the gypsies, everyone... It's weird how it's almost like you're still allowed to be racist against the gypsies, even today.
There is a meme running around which says, you got Europeans when lecturing Americans on blacks, a hippie. Europeans when talking about gypsies, Hitler. And it really is like that. Some of the biggest shitlibs I know in Macedonia are like, oh, those gypsies, they're fetpost. We should fetpost them. We should fetpost them in gas chambers. When you're looking at when you grow up around gypsies, and they are darker skinned, they are because they're Australoids. They come from the subcontinent, right? But yes, they're not like the Brahmins. The Brahmins have the most
Aryan admixture. They are Dravidian or something, I don't know. But yeah, it's weird because nobody about knows race, this.
Like I think the subracial group is Dravidian, but they're macro racist Australoids, same as the Aborigines.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. In Australia. And you can see it in their faces that these are racial aliens, and they live like racial aliens, and they behave like racial aliens, and they consider themselves racial aliens. So if you have dark skin in Macedonia, that's a very, even if you're not a gypsy, because there are dark-skinned Macedonians, right? That's the thing. We are, someone in the chat said it was very clever. I'm going to use that in Bantz. Basically, you say you're Macedonian, people aren't sure, you cannot be sure about their race, or at least, you know, subracial grouping, because we got Germans, we got Slavs, we got Mediterraneans, we got Alpinids over here, and some people are very dark, those who are, you know, Mediterranean admixed, and even so, national symbol is the sun, a lot of sunlight in here, you should see me in the summer, you know, I'm basically a Schwarze, and it's one of these things. Dark skin is associated with gypsies, and we don't like it here. It's just low status. We consider it filthy. We don't like dark skin in Macedonia.
Well, I think that people have this feeling everywhere. I don't think it's a consequence of culture making people racist. I think it's a sort of instinctual thing, and I think they have the reverse feeling of it when they see a blonde, white, blue-eyed woman. It's like, yeah, a goddess to them. There's no sense, oh, that person's inferior to me. It's I think it's an immediate instinctual decision. That person is superior, yeah, in some sense to me. That's why I want to mix with her and, you know, get those.
Well,
genes.
I don't think there's a rational process.
No, of course not. Of course not. I think it's completely instinctual.
People are like, I was thinking about, people are saying to me, why? It's like, like I said, you know, just walking through Egypt with, and I'm not that fair haired, right? And I'm pale, I'm fair skinned, but not that fair haired. I got brown eyes, but walking through Egypt, they were amazed at me, right? My coif of blonde hair, and it was blonder at the time because it darkens with age. It's just one of those things. It's something that everyone in the world accepts. They are amazed at our physical. And look, if I saw someone who was pitch black, not like an African-American, but like a genuine proper Congoloid, I would be impressed by it. See, that's the thing. We are impressed by the exotic. Maybe I wouldn't see him as, you know, an Aryan god, but I would definitely be impressed by his exoticism. Definitely.
Well, there are some who are extremely dark. They're almost black, literally black.
Those look better to me, like a almost pitch black Congoloid. They look better to me than the mulatto Americans, if I'm being honest. Like, they at least they look like they belong to a certain category, and you know, when they smile, you got the good contrast if they have the good teeth. So that's the thing, I guess.
Yeah, with the sort of mixed race, that's a more depressing matter, really, isn't it? All right. Okay, well, let's, I think that is all the questions. Someone said, you the man, Nix, lol. There you go. All right, so I'll wrap this one up, and I'll be back in 20 minutes with the next one, which I've already forgotten who the next one is. Let's see. Oh, it's Apostolic Majesty. So, okay, I'll be back then.
Say hi to him from me, and hope he's corrected his stance on the Albanian question. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. All right.
I could say some worse things, but I'm not going to.
Please don't. Please don't. Okay, I'll put that soy face up one last time. fucking awful. Okay, there we go. And I'll be back in a wee while, not looking like that, hopefully. And I'll see you then. In the meantime, Nix Gilvey, thank you for taking part in Millennial.
Bye-bye, Wells.
All right, bye-bye.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. a unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.